Today is the fourth day of our September-October 7-day session at Chapin Mill, and it's the 3rd of October 2018. And we're going to continue to read from Attaining the Way, a guide to the practice of Chan Buddhism. And we're going to be continuing at least the first part of the Taisho, reading from and commenting on teachings by Master Boshan, whose formal name is Wu Yi Yuan Lai, and he was a Ming Dynasty Chinese master. When practicing, it is crucial not to arouse the least bit of extraneous thought. Whether walking, staying, sitting, or lying, simply bring forth the fundamental question of the Huado to arouse the doubt sensation and generate a great resolve to find out the answer. And of course, not just Huado practice helps us to release extraneous thought. It's the same with the breath and with just sitting. If there is the least bit of extraneous thought, it is what the ancient ones refer to as fatal poison entering the heart. It's the poison of our delusions. Not only referred to this as the fatal poison of entering the heart. Adherents should be careful. The so-called extraneous thoughts are thoughts that relate to worldly phenomena. In other words, mundane concerns that these surface in Sishin, but almost all of them can wait, and we will certainly pick up our mundane concerns again after Sishin. But we simply don't need to concern ourselves with them in Sishin, because what are we going to do about them anyway? We're just going to ruminate on them. Other than the thorough investigation of mind, all other good things within the Buddha Dharma are considered extraneous thoughts. This is an important point when you think, okay, we're going to set down our mundane concerns, but then if we have lofty thoughts about the Buddha Dharma, that's okay. But actually, when we're engaging in Sazen, good things such as the Buddha Dharma are also considered to be extraneous thoughts. Not only all the good things within the Buddha Dharma, but also whatever can be grasped, shunned, attached to, or transformed outside the mind essence is considered extraneous thoughts. So our task is to just put it all down. Noble, lofty, exalted. Got to put it all down. Because all of it is still within the realm of the conditioned. Passing phenomena of the mind. In the course of practice, most people complain that they cannot apply their efforts well. Precisely because they cannot apply themselves, they should apply themselves even more. It is like a person who is lost. it makes great sense for him to find his way. He cannot say, well, since I'm lost, I will quit. This is a very important point. I think everybody has probably at one time or another got into a place with their practice where it just feels like you can't go on. This just doesn't seem to be, you feel stymied. You don't know how you can as it says here, apply yourself. But in actual fact, we can. And it's a great thing when we discover this for ourselves, that even if we're at a point of just feeling at a loss, that we can go on from that point. This is an image in one of the stories of masters and disciples. I think it might be Huaizhang, I'm not sure, but this is Hakyakudro in Japanese. There's a fire and it appears to be dead, and his student says, well, the fire's gone out. And then Hakyakudro says, see if you can't find an ember. And the student tries to stir up the ashes and see if there's an ember. And he says, no, it's the fire's completely dead. And then Hakyakudro comes in and he persistently stirs around in the ashes and finds one, this tiny little burning ember. That ember is always there. If we look hard enough, probe deeply enough, We can apply ourselves even when it feels like we can't, because that feeling of not being able to apply ourselves is made up of thoughts, and our thoughts never paint the whole picture. They can't capture the entirety of things. So they're always partial, always limited. They always narrow the universe down and reduce it. We have to learn to take everything that our thoughts tell us with a grain of salt. An ancient worthy once said, "The gate of liberation is gateless. One enters the way without intentions. The most important thing is to personally enter it." The gate of liberation is gateless. This is, of course, where the title for the Mumon Khan, Gateless Gate or Gateless Barrier, came from. In fact, this is Bolshanas, I think, quoting from a master. Xuan Sha Shibei, and Mumon actually quotes him at the end of the Mumon Khan. "The gate of liberation is gateless. One enters the way without intentions." The gate of liberation is gateless in the sense that there's no point in this vast and wide universe where one can't enter. The gates are everywhere. One enters the way without intentions. Eventually we have to give up all our plans, all our scheming. Become, in a sense, naked. The gate of liberation is gateless. One enters the way without intentions. The most important thing is to personally enter it. Think of that as a saying, you've got to be in to win. We've got to keep picking ourselves up and putting us back, ourselves back on the way, on the path. Every time we fall off it, every time we feel like we can't apply ourselves, that's right there. That is the time to apply ourselves. The most fearful thing in practice is a witty or clever mind. There's a footnote about this. Witty or clever mind is a rendering for Ling Yi Xin. This mental state has other negative connotations, such as being overly intellectual, being insincere, and desiring shortcuts in practice. The witty mind is like food that annuls medicine. If you give rise to the least bit of wit, then even when genuine medicine appears in front of you, it cannot cure you. If you are a true person of Chan, your eyes should be blind and your ears should be deaf. When thoughts arise, they should be like they're smashed up against a silver mountain or an iron wall. When you can be like this, then you will conform to genuine practice. There's different ways, the broad spectrum of ways in which this witty mind can get in our way. We can sit on the mat, enjoying our wit, reveling in it. I've heard sometimes about from people that they spend the time composing limericks. Jokes about Sesshin, planning a New Year's skit for the entertainment night. Writing report about Sesshin that is very perceptive and spiritual. In this way, we kind of use words defensively to fill the void, and that's why the witty mind is like food that annuls medicine, because you're essentially filling up the mind. So that it isn't receptive anymore. When he says a true person of Chan should have eyes that are blind and ears that are deaf. He's talking to becoming absorbed in the koan or the other practice. When there's absorption in the questioning, then the mind is open, it's receptive, and it can appreciate the Dharma that is being taught by all the 10,000 things. In the course of practice, do not fear mistakes. Rather, fear not realizing that you are wrong. Even though you make mistakes, if you turn your thoughts around and admit them, then this is having what it takes to become a Buddha or an ancestor. This is the essential way out of birth and death. This is the useful weapon to rip through Mara's grip. Mara's personification of our self-partiality, of attachment to ego. We're going back to this wit. It's the one of the problems of wit is that if we are attached to our cleverness, our witty mind, then we're not likely to realize our errors. Maybe a decade ago, 15 years ago, a film came out called Wit. Had Emma Thompson in the main role. She played an English professor, and she'd spent her life working on the poetry of John Donne. She was an expert in it, and his poetry, one of the main themes in the poetry is death. And also relationship to the divine, these two things. And this English professor then comes down with a very a severe form of ovarian cancer and has to go through all these very painful treatments and all kinds of indignities as she gets more and more sick. And she finds that her former reliance on wit is not much help as she goes through this very difficult time. She doesn't have many visitors because she was apparently a difficult person. Didn't make friends. There was wit there, but there wasn't warmth. And in the film, it's her illness, her trials that bring her to a new understanding of death and relationship to something beyond herself. And the film ends with words from John Donne: "Death, be not proud." In the course of practice, just wholeheartedly work on one gongan, one koan. Never try to analyze or interpret all the gongans. Although you may be able to interpret them, they will remain mere interpretations, not enlightenment. The Lotus Sutra says, the Dharma cannot be attained by means of thinking and discrimination. The Sutra of Complete Enlightenment says, if one tries to measure the state of Tathagata's complete enlightenment by means of the thinking mind, then it will be like using the light of a lightning bug to heat up Mount Sumeru. It can never be accomplished. Chan Master Dongshang Yangje once said, if one plans to learn this profound Dharma by means of the conscious mind, it will be like a person walking west trying to go east. In sum, anyone who tries to fathom the meaning of a gongan must feel ashamed and know humility. This word ashamed has a slightly different meaning in Asia than it does here. And it's particularly, can be the healthy shame of, for us too, of looking at the great masters and seeing their accomplishments and then seeing our own meager understanding and aspiring to live up to those old masters, their achievements. To keep working, to keep deepening the practice, to not settle for limited understanding. Shame can turn into something unhealthy if it solidifies into guilt and we define ourselves as being as hopeless cases, just in comparison to these old masters. Then everything kind of gets stuck, and there's no movement. But if we can practice humility in the sense of receptivity and keeping alive our aspiration, being realistic about where we're at and how much more there is to do. Rinzai said, virtuous monks, just be ordinary. Don't put on airs. Don't cling to your achievements. Don't raise yourself up above others. In the course of practice, you should not try to rationalize things. Just persistently and stubbornly work on your investigation until you arouse the doubt sensation. If you rationalize about your practice, then your practice will be dry and stale. If it stays at the intellectual level, if we're just working with our thoughts about the practice or the Dharma, then it's going to have this dry, stale quality to it. It goes back to what we were saying earlier. We have to find a way to make it personal, our practice. It applies to all the different practices we do. We need to relate it to our life and our life koans, and then to practice from the heart or even from the gut. I think this is what is meant by sometimes you hear the instruction, put your question in your hara. Put the koan in your hara. It doesn't mean to literally put it in your hara, but to let the questioning arise from our depths. Again, this is what is meant by earnestness or sincerity. The question comes from you could say some kind of integrated place in us. Even if that integrated place is the longing to feel integrated, the longing to feel whole, not separate. In the course of practice, do not engage in idleness. You must have a strong determination to understand this principle. If you are idle, then you will spend your life as an idler. This great thing, hidden under the seam of your cloth, will never be discovered. That is if you're an idler. And again, this again refers to the Lotus Sutra of having a jewel, a precious jewel, sewn into your clothing and not knowing that it's there and so forth, not being able to access it. Make it functioning in one's life. It is like a person searching for something that has been lost. If you can find it, then your task will be fulfilled. If you cannot, then you may come to a halt in a state of idleness. If you cannot arouse the intention to search for it, then even if the lost article appears in front of you, you will not be aware of it. This is because you are not searching for it. So it is important that we turn our mind towards a Buddha nature and search. That the searching is expressed in different ways, in different practices, but it's there. Whether it's shining a light on the breath, or the illumination aspect of shikantaza, illuminating the body mind, or in koan work, this questioning. Each of these is a kind of searching. It's applying the mind to the great matter. And part of this has to be with the questioning. It has to be that we drop our ideas about what we think we're looking for. Imagining that we know what it's going to be like when we find or discover this true nature of ours. Because if there's still some idea in our mind, then we may miss it. Everybody's probably experienced this. When you're looking for something, you're looking for, say, some documents, and you look everywhere for them, and you look up and down, high and low, and you don't find them. And then you look again and you still don't find them. And then finally you look in the drawer that you've already looked 5 times into, and you go through every single paper in the drawer, and of course you find them, these papers. And the problem was that all along you thought they were in a blue folder, so you were looking for a blue folder. So even though the papers were there, you didn't see them, you didn't find them, because you were looking for some image that didn't accord with what the papers actually look like. So we have to drop all our imaginings, all our fantasies, everything we've read in books about what it's like when people wake up. In the course of practice, you should pay no attention to those so-called experiences that are like sparks from struck flint. What is the point of being caught up in those fleeting experiences of lights and images at your sensory entrances, sense gates, in other words, sometimes appearing, sometimes not? You must personally experience and verify enlightenment. If you can truly fulfill and achieve this, it will be like seeing your own parents in broad daylight. No mistake about it. So he's referring here to the various body-mind phenomena that arise when we sit, different kinds of experiences we have, lights or images. We can become fascinated by these things, but they're just passing phenomena. We'll have a certain life, and then they'll fade away. And we can just trust that. Say they're disturbing things. This also can happen. That to just remind ourselves that they'll have a certain life, and then they'll pass away. When practicing, you should not recite the Gongan. What is the use of mere recitation? I do not teach people to recite the Huado, but just continuously to try to bring forth the Huado to their attention. So this is different from just mechanically reciting the koan. It's not quite yet questioning, but just to bring it up, to keep it alive. We may, at times the questioning may not be there, but just to bring the koan to our attention, to hold it in the mind. He goes on to talk about working with wu, which is what Mumon said in Chinese when asked, does a dog have the Buddha nature? But we'll just replace these the wu with mu. If you are observing the word mu, then from the word mu the doubt must arise. So it arises from the koan itself. So even if you don't have that doubt mass, something active, feeling active, then to just keep the koan in mind, to keep bringing it to one's attention, then out of that, the sense of wonder, perplexity can arise. If you're observing the cypress tree, then it is from these words, the cypress tree, that doubt must arise. And this is the koan where somebody asked Master Joshu, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? And Joshua said the cypress tree in the courtyard was sometimes translated as the oak tree in the courtyard. So again, what was his meaning when he said this? What was he pointing to? If you are observing the Huado, where does the one return to? Then naturally, this is where the doubt sensation will arise. If you can arouse the doubt sensation, then the 10 directions all become this mass of doubt. You will not know the existence of the body and mind that your parents gave you, through and through. Your whole being is just a mass of doubt, unaware of the existence of the 10 directions, no inside or outside. Everything is fused into this one great mass. It will then only be a matter of time before the mental band around the barrel explodes. Until it breaks open and reveals itself. We just become one with the question. Or as I sometimes said, the question is the answer. Our time is nearly up. We're going to go on to some of the teachings of the 19th and 20th century master Xu Yun. Probably just have time to do a very little bit of biographical material, then maybe one or two passages from his teaching or paragraphs rather. So just for people who haven't heard of this great master, Xu Yun, his Dharma name was Yanshe Deqing, and his dates are 1839 to 1959. He's better known by the name he gave himself, Xu Yun, meaning empty cloud. The most illustrious Chan master in recent times, Xu Yun was known for many things, such as his meditative absorptions and ascetic practices, which included extended fasting, never lying down to sleep, burning one of his fingers, and this was out of filial piety to his deceased mother. His mother died in childbirth, and this was something that weighed on Master Xu Yun his whole life. He felt a deep sense of gratitude to his mother and karmic debt. He once did a pilgrimage that went for thousands of miles, during which he made a prostration after every three steps walked. And he dedicated the merits of this very long pilgrimage to his mother. Xu Yun's enlightenment occurred at age 56 during a three-month retreat when an attendant accidentally spilled hot water on Xu Yun's hand, thus causing Xu Yun to drop his teacup. Xu Yun's enlightenment ensued from the sound of the teacup shattering on the floor. Although his enlightenment occurred relatively late in life, he lived for another 64 years to a ripe age of 120. During those years, he focused on holding intensive Chan retreats for both lay people and monastics and on rebuilding ruined temples throughout China. And I mention here a book which is an autobiography of Xu Yun, translated by Charles Look, which we have in our library and is in Arnold Park, and it's a fascinating book, very inspiring. And the part that we're going to read from is, the translator suggests, addressed, geared towards serious beginners. So that's us. I'll just take up maybe a couple of sentences here. The purpose of investigating chant, this is headed up, prerequisites for beginning chan practice. The purpose of investigating chan is to illuminate the mind and see your self nature. Sometimes late in Sesshin, especially in the evening rounds, I would find myself saying to myself, what is it I'm doing? What am I supposed to be doing here? And it can be helpful just to be reminded about what we're doing. The purpose of what we're doing is to illuminate the mind and see our self-nature. Whatever our practice is, that's the purpose. You must eradicate the mind's impurities so as to personally perceive the true fragrance, face of your self-nature. The mind's impurities are wandering thoughts and attachments. Self-nature is the wisdom and virtue of the Tathagata. The Tathagata is just a way of referring to the Buddha. Sentient beings, that's us, are replete with the wisdom and virtue of Buddhas. They are not two and not separated from one another. If you can leave behind wandering thoughts and attachments, then you will attain this wisdom and virtue that it was within you. This is Buddhahood. Otherwise, you remain an ordinary sentient being. It is because you and I have been for limitless kalpas wallowing in birth and death, defiled for a long time, and unable to immediately cast off wandering thoughts, that we cannot perceive our intrinsic nature. For this reason, the first prerequisite of investigating chan is to eradicate wandering thoughts. Again, basic teaching, but it's very important to understand this teaching, otherwise we can go astray in our practice. Our suffering, our confusion, our greed, our hatred, all of this comes out of conditioning. The ways in which we have been misusing our minds and our bodies. And it's helpful to remember that this has been happening for a long time and persistently, that we've been misusing our minds and laying down these habits in the mind stream. And so they're not going to be all cleared up in a short space of time. Doesn't mean we can't actually see right down to the bottom of the mind in an instant, because that bottom is always there, that wisdom and compassion is always there, but the habit forces take time to see through and eradicate. Whether it's before we have a tip of the tongue taste or after, that work has to be done methodically, persistently. It's just that seeing our true nature, getting a glimpse, can give us a greater sense of purpose and an understanding of the task that we're doing, of waking up and illuminating the mind, and then living out of that illuminated mind. Just one last little bit, and it's always the bit that we ask ourselves, well, how do we eradicate wandering thoughts? Shakyamuni Buddha taught much on this subject. His simplest and most direct teaching is the word stop, from the expression stopping is bodhi. Bodhi is, means awakening, awakened mind. Stopping is bodhi. Or just to another way of talking about basic practice is stop and look. Represent the two sides of practice, the calming, pacifying the mind, and then the illuminating or investigating the mind. Calming and insight. Well, maybe stopping is a good idea. Our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows. Beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow